Occupy a Job on Wall Street is an autobiographical novel about New York City in the aughts, centering around a protagonist mentored by sociopaths. Episode 100, The Power of Round Numbers. The Black Death was actually caused by bacteria, not a virus, but still managed to wipe out half of Europe's population in the middle of the 14th century. Even then, it wasn't done with us, causing a couple more pandemics and still kills the odd person today. It was one of the greatest tragedies to befall the human race. Can anything good be said about the plague? As it turns out, yes. The survivors and their descendants end up healthier and live longer, meaning past pandemics served as gigantic natural selection events by removing the weakest of us from the gene pool. Because so many people died, it's widely assumed that the Black Death killed indiscriminately. But that's not true. Elderly people and the poor were much likelier to kick the bucket. To be sure, the plague killed the wealthy as well, but as with most infectious diseases, the healthiest just had a better chance of surviving. In any case, all of our descendants that made it through the Black Death inherited a much better world. Food prices dropped, the value of labor increased, and there was a boost in the standard of living. Hedge funds operate alongside a similar principle. The key to understanding any investment fund is identifying the competence of management at the top of the food chain. These people run the company that does the actual investing, and they generate a fee on total assets they manage, as well as a percentage of the profits, commonly known as an incentive. Most management companies have a majority of their own savings in the underlying fund, as well as a duty to their investors, so it's unclear why you might need an incentive to make money, but there you have it. Our business has changed dramatically from the salad days of the early 21st century, but for the sake of argument, let's assume I used to work at a $10 billion hedge fund with a 2-in-20 model. That is, the management company was paid 2% or $200 million a year just to turn up and breathe through their mouths, and then another 20% of whatever profits were made. So if the fund had a 20% year, which was not unusual in the industry heyday, then the incentive fee was $400 million. These numbers are so large as to become almost meaningless, but just stop what you're doing and imagine. $600 million to cover some expenses and then pay out bonuses to employees. Were we celebrating as a good year became apparent? No. Obviously, it was time to cut jobs, to remove extra mouths so the rest of us could eat better. Anyway, one year I'm walking around the hedge fund wondering where the sword was going to fall. As always, I'm feeling secure in my own position because the trading desk wasn't seen as a cost center. In part because it was a bit of a black box to most people, but also we were supposedly underpaid relative to the rest of the buy side. This provided a little job security, and I left the fishbowl to wander around the rest of the zoo, wondering which of the betas were most likely to be culled. I pass a group of Asian analysts that always clustered together in the main room. They were a real pain in the dick. Anytime you'd question them about something, they'd chatter amongst themselves, laugh, and then use the word heuristic in their answer. Even the Jewish guys in the firm didn't know how to use that expression in a sentence. But our quant team didn't make any money this year, so they have no real sponsor to protect them. Best guess, the whole lot are for the wood chipper. Good riddance. Perhaps a heuristic experience for them. One of the energy portfolio managers raises an eyebrow as I pass his office. I'd almost blown him up earlier in the year when he'd attended one of our fundraisers and returned to the office wearing an I Love New York t-shirt under his otherwise pristine suit. My understanding is he got so hammered in Chinatown that he had walked into our office, slapped the wrong assistant on the ass, and then fallen asleep at his desk without drawing the blinds. The whole morning, people wandered by laughing at him until I banged on the window yelling, "Hey, wake the fuck up!" If that happened today, we'd have a bit of a show trial for him, followed by humiliation, a public apology, and calls for his resignation. But back then, all that mattered was competence. He's made money for the firm, and good on him. He'll bank generational money that year. One of the assistants, Sean the Dwarf, is probably safe too. All the traders like Sean, so if we found out they were planning to fire him, the trading desk would lock him inside a filing drawer or another enclosed space for a full afternoon. Human resources took the bait every time and went spastic over that sort of shit, and sure enough, he'd be safe for another year. One of the macro PMs also had a good hand to play this year. Everyone liked him because, after a hilarious divorce, this guy would sit in his office just giving away bottles of Court and Charlemagne to anyone who felt like a drink. His hot wife, Spence, tried to accuse him of sexual abuse that year, but a photo in the New York Post of her wearing nothing but high heels and a riding crop took care of that in short order. This guy called 12 of the past two recessions, was always ranting about the US dollar being debased by fraudulent activity at the Fed, how Fannie and Freddie were doomed. But in macro, being late to trade is often the same as being right. Events had converged fortuitously for him, and he was laughing all the way to the bank. The next person I see, well, let's say I still wouldn't be surprised to see him caught with two dead hookers and a pile of coke. He could be relied upon to lie and cheat and steal. That was the extent of his reliability, but at least he showed a marvelous predictability. He'd wander around the trading desk trying to see what the larger accounts were doing, so he could take the best ideas and front-run the order flow to boot. Worse yet, he'd pick his nose and wipe it on the walls like a dog peeing around its territory. He's as friendly as cancer. I gotta avoid him. So instead, I walk over to the high-yield team to try to figure out who those guys will fire. It turns out the best of them quit for Goldman Sachs, so probably no layoffs there. I met one of the traders that resigned out drinking once, and he was good bad. Certainly not evil like the rest of Goldman back then. Unfortunately for them, he later died in a kiteboarding accident, strangled by a rope. After that, he drowned. Then a shark ate him. Then an orca came along and ate that shark. I shake my head at this stupid business and head back to the trading desk. I had a spring in my step back in those days. Controlling a commission budget in the tens of millions, it was better than being president. When I get to my seat, it's oddly silent. Everyone is watching one another suspiciously, and none will look me in the eye when I throw them a questioning glance. It's very strange. I look over at the new head trader's desk, and it's empty. Fuck. I have a bad feeling about this. In the delicate silence of the room, my head begins to spin a little. I thought the trading desk was safe from job cuts this year, but I suddenly realize graveyards are full of indispensable men. I see the head trader's assistant has noted my return and is picking up her phone. Best guess, I have about 30 seconds. How to use it? A senior trader glances over at me with a sympathetic look. He's a New Zealander, originally hired as a temp and had the relaxed demeanor of someone who assumed his time on Wall Street was temporary, even after 10 years or so. I never saw him take a day for granted, and even now I gather he'll drink with anyone paying for a pint. Not the smartest, and by no means the hardest worker, but always the luckiest person in the room. The Kiwi reaches over to take my company BlackBerry out of my hands and then switches it to airplane mode. With a start, I realize every email, every file, every contact card is on it. A decade of early mornings and hard work. He passes it back, flips me the bird, and returns to his trading desk. That's it. Information is oil. My pathway is unlocked. I just need to keep the BlackBerry secure because now no one can wipe it remotely. I pass it off to a safe pair of hands, then scan my desk for anything else I want, but the family is ringing my personal line. And I'm out of time. This is it. The end. I shrug, stand up straight, walk out to a new day. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, we're also done. As of today, 1,000 of my closest friends listen to this podcast. It's been said that the first 1,000 is harder than the next 100,000, but we've done the best we can, and the rest is up to you, our audience. While we may post the occasional episode going forward, it's well past time to move on to greener pastures. I'll leave you with a final thought. Ordinary life is pretty complex stuff, but I believe as the pandemic recedes here, America will head into another roaring 20s. It's a remarkable time to be alive. Not only is the world going to get exponentially better, it'll be a less competitive environment because a large proportion of the population has been fatally wounded by the tragic events of this year. I'm not referring to the virus itself, which is fairly harmless to most of us. I mean they'll be damaged by their lack of social interaction. By mindlessly watching corporate news at home and doom-scrolling through the internet, or captured by partisan politics and groupthink. The future belongs to the rest of us.